a dress, a bugle, a cane, a punch bowl. They're ordinary objects, but they tell extraordinary stories, the stories of Wisconsin residents who were caught up in the Civil War. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What do these artifacts tell us about the way people lived and thought in Wisconsin in the 1860s? What happened to these mementos after the war, and what are the stories behind their owners? Our guest is Leslie Belay, curator of textiles and costumes at the Wisconsin Historical Society and the author of various articles about the holdings there.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
When I was looking at one of your magazine articles about some of the Civil War mementos, the artifacts, the objects, I was struck at how every pot or bowl or vest or knife has a story behind it. I'm curious how the State Historical Society decides what to keep, what to display, and how much stuff there is.
Well, we'll start with how much stuff. We have about 100,000 artifacts in the museum collection, which is three-dimensional collection. Nowadays, we're very keen that we only take objects that have stories with them and have Wisconsin stories specifically. In the past, we weren't as particular. And the ones that we've picked out for today, we knew had stories with them. I have researched them further to fill out that story and learn more about them. And that makes the object more valuable to us.
And how many of these things are on display at any given time?
We probably keep 2 to 5% of the collections on display at one time.
You rotate through occasionally?
Occasionally, especially textiles and paper have to be rotated. And we do have changing exhibits, so we can talk. We have a permanent exhibit that deals with the history of Wisconsin. And then we always have changing exhibits that pick up certain ideas that we can do more with.
Now, when you talk about textiles, the first thing we think about would be uniforms and flags, but that's not necessarily what you would have on display.
No. We don't have many uniforms at all because in the 1990s, we signed a memorandum of agreement with the Wisconsin Veterans Museum that they would be in charge of the military history of the state. So at that time, we turned over all of our Civil War flags, Civil War to the present, flags and uniforms and any military paraphernalia as well.
So let's say we come to the State Historical Society to see something about the Civil War in Wisconsin. Is there an object in particular that stands out for you as a one that has a story that tells us something about Wisconsin's involvement in the Civil War?
Fortunately, there aren't any Civil War artifacts on exhibit right now. We did do an exhibit in 2011 for the 150th anniversary. But it has come and gone. So
are they stored in some kind of warehouse?
Yes, they're stored in the basement of the Wisconsin Historical Society building.
But I assume you have digital archives. I mean, do you have pictures?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Some of the things we have are on display, or are online, rather. But the Civil War collection is not one of them.
Now, getting back to the textiles, one of the things that you have written about, I believe, is a dress.
Yes.
And what would be the story behind that dress that would make it stand out in this collection of 100,000 artifacts?
The little girl's dress? We have a little girl's dress that was a refugee dress. The Wisconsin connection is kind of tenuous because she moved to Wisconsin in her later years. But as a little girl, she lived in St. Joseph, Missouri, and her father was a Confederate sympathizer. And so that put her in a predicament because Missouri went with the Union. She was only 5 years old when the war started. And so her father went off to join the Confederate Army. And her mother and the kids were basically asked to leave town. And they decided to go to Nacogdoches, Texas, which was a good, safe place to be. There's no battles in Texas during the Civil War. But while they were there, there was a lot of hardship and deprivation. And one of them was finding fabric. Fabric was not coming in from the East Coast. It wasn't coming in from Europe. So this rich family in town turned their house into a fabric production. They did the spinning and the weaving there. And we have a dress made from that fabric. So she was a northern refugee fleeing south with her mother and her brother, who was about 7 at the time. And this was something that happened to her as a little girl. Later on in life, she did move to Madison, Wisconsin, And around that time, around 1920, it was offered to us as a Civil War relic.
And what do we see? Like, if we look at this dress, what does it look like? What is it made of? And why is it sort of something worth preserving?
It doesn't look like much compared to other dresses from that time period. It stands out in that it's a very coarse cotton, kind of tan, not very interesting looking on its own. It's its story that makes it interesting. But it's just, it speaks to kind of hardship and a hard life caused by the Civil War and how this woman who lived in Wisconsin had experienced it. But it's a basic 1860s dress. It does have long sleeves. It's about knee length. And that's about it.
Well, speaking of these personal objects that have significance and tell stories, you also have at least one pocket watch. And back in the Civil War, pocket watch was sort of a major possession for a man to have and also a major possession for a man to lose. And some of these pocket watches, when they turn up at prisons like Andersonville or Libby Prison in the South, fall into various hands.
Yes.
How did you come by this one in your collection?
We did have one that belonged to Dealton Titchener. Since it came to us around 1915, I think, and has since been turned over to the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. But Dealton was from Seneca, Wisconsin, which is Crawford County. He was actually 40 years old when he signed up to be in the Army.
They were going up to, what, age 45 at one point?
Yeah, he didn't have to at 40. He didn't really have to go volunteer, but he felt very strongly. He was a very strong Union sympathizer. So he joined the Army, but he got let out a year later on disability. But then his neighbor, a year or two later, refused to volunteer for the Army, and he was just disgusted with this neighbor. So he joined in his stead and went back into the Army, this time in the, it was the 36th Company H. That company went to Virginia, saw battle, and he was captured in May of 1864 and sent to Andersonville because he was a private. Privates went to Andersonville. Officers went to Libby Prison and other sort of nicer places.
Nicer, in a very loose sense of the word.
That.
Yeah, that's right.
So Dealton Titchener ended up in Andersonville. He lasted about 4 months, 3 or 4 months before he died. The question was whether what he died of, jaundice or starvation. But when he was a member of the 36, we think possibly because he was the elder in the group in Company H, they presented him with a pocket watch as kind of a to express their gratitude to him. And when he went to Andersonville, it was removed from his person by the Confederates.
Did it have his name engraved on it? Is that how we know?
Yes. In fact, it says, presented to Sergeant E. Titchener by the members of Company H, 36th Regiment, Wisconsin Volunteers.
And so you say it was, he was relieved of his watch. It sounds like
relieved.
A polite way of saying it. But
he was relieved of his watch. But the interesting thing is he died while he was at Andersonville. His gravestone is there. You can go visit it if you want. But his Company H felt very strongly after the war was over that they wanted to get this watch back. And they bought it back from the Confederate Army and handed it over to his wife. And I believe it was his great-granddaughter who eventually donated it to us.
You also include in a magazine article a picture of a vest worn by a woman. It's, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's a vivandière jacket.
It's a jacket, not a vest. And she's a vivandière, mm-hmm. is how I would say it. But yes, this is actually really a wonderful piece. It's a blue velvet with gold braid trim. A vivandière is something that doesn't exist anymore. It started probably with the Napoleonic Wars. And it was a woman who did not have medical training, but she would go into the field after battle and care for the soldiers. It really took off during the Crimean War.
The one that brought us Florence Nightingale.
Yes, exactly. Florence Nightingale was more of a nurse than a vivandière, but there was this sort of lower level person. They're usually upper middle or upper middle class women who are doing this. So they're also they're there to represent the domestic home front and to keep the soldiers behaving because they want to look good in front of this woman. In the Civil War, where there were a handful of them. There are not a lot of them. They were also called Daughters of the Regiment and were, you know, viewed as very special people.
So they were volunteers, more or less?
They were definitely volunteering, but they were not considered a member of the regiment. Their names will not show up on the rolls of the regiment.
And this is a rather elaborate jacket. So am I right in assuming that she wouldn't have worn this in the field, but rather for some kind of ceremonial, like a parade or something?
That's correct. We know because of letters written back and newspaper articles about her, because she was kind of – this was an unusual thing to do. She was around 26, 28 when she was out there. And to have a middle-class woman in the middle of the battlefield was mind-boggling to begin with. And so we know people wrote about her. Soldiers wrote home about her. And we know that she wore basically a bloomer outfit, which would be a short skirt and long pants and a jacket. And that was usually brown wool, the one that gets mentioned the most frequently. The one we have is her dress uniform. And I actually found a description that said what the rest of the uniform consisted of, which was red bloomer pants, a white skirt, and a headdress with a red and white and blue feather.
And presumably she would have needed something like bloomers in order to be out in the fields, if you think about the way women of the time dressed in such elaborate and not very functional dresses.
This was the era of the hoop skirt, so yeah. She's not wearing a hoop skirt. She's wearing something a little more practical. It's accepted in this context. It wouldn't be accepted in an everyday context. Bloomer outfits wouldn't have been. But because she's working in a dirty environment, in a rough environment, she could get away with it. It's also the regiment that she was with, which came out of Eau Claire or Menominee, were Zouave-like. So she's also kind of reflecting the Zouave look, which does include baggy pants.
The Zouave was what inspired by maybe a Turkish look, and there were actually soldiers that would dress in this. I can't imagine they actually fought in them.
They did at the beginning. They realized red was not a good color to wear in battle.
Baggy red was maybe even worse.
They're based on Turkish, but they really are inspired. The French took up the Zouave uniform first, and Americans felt the French were the best military, and so that they're the ones they want to emulate. And so it's not surprising that they picked up on a Zouave outfit at first. So this was worn. This one we have was worn by Eliza Wilson, and her father founded Menominee, Wisconsin. He was very well-to-do. He as a lumber baron type person. He formed the company that she joined. It was first called the Dunn County Pinery Rifles, but later became Company K of the 5th Wisconsin. And so she signed up, and she brought a maid. She brought her own clothes, and she brought a carriage with chestnut horses.
Was there controversy about her being out there?
Not at first. She was viewed as the daughter of the regiment, and she was, as one soldier wrote, that the sight of her refreshes us and gives us courage. But what happened is they got to Virginia. They were part of the Iron Brigade. The Company K in 5th Wisconsin was in the Iron Brigade. The Iron Brigade saw a lot of bloody battles. And about June of 62, she joined right as the war started. In June of 62, they decided having a woman of her type in the battlefield area was stressful to everybody because they felt they had to worry about her as well as the battle going on. So they asked her to return home, which she did. But later on in life, she was asked to join the GAR post in her area and treated as a fellow soldier.
What other artifacts do you have that convey sort of the women's side of the story in the Civil War?
The other side of the Civil War that have to do with women, it's a little harder story to tell. Some of the home front pieces that we have in our collection deal with things sent back by soldiers to their wives and their mothers that they acquired on the road or were given as gifts by people in the South if they did something noble. But the other things we have are related to sanitary fairs. I don't know if you have heard of those.
Yes, heard of, but explain that as a phenomenon of the Civil War.
Sanitary fairs helped raise money for soldiers. They were created by women, and it was how women could really have an active role in making it. This is in the North, generally, not in the South, to help keep the soldiers' life as sanitary as possible, which is where that comes from, but also provide food and medical supplies and anything else that they might need while they're out in the field. So they had sanitary fairs, which helped raise money. And we do have pieces, not very many, but we do have a few pieces made by women that were sold at the fair, including a pair of knitted doll shoes that were purchased at a sanitary. We don't know who exactly made them, but we know who purchased them was an officer who then gave them to a little girl in Wisconsin. but he bought them at the sanitary fair in Chicago. So
how do we ever get that story? I mean, look, behind a pair of doll socks.
Luckily, the person who gave them to us, which is not uncommon in the early 20th century, is to pin notes to your stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so I love getting collections where someone around 1915, 1920, 25 sat down with all their mementos and just wrote out little notes. This was grandpa, you know, so-and-so's. This was whatever it was. And just pinned them to it. And when we get those, I just feel like I'm in pig heaven.
Yeah. And do you ever have to kind of screen out ones that seem a little embellished or exaggerated?
Maybe not embellished or exaggerated, but possibly not correct. where they're saying, you know, where we've gotten something where they say, though, this is a 1830s something, and I look at it and I can tell right away it's from the late 19th century. So, yeah, you do take it with a grain of salt. You always take oral histories with a grain of salt,
well,
and you try to prove them in the written record.
You don't have to embellish the story behind that pocket knife that you have.
Pocket knife that we have is probably one of the more important pieces we have related to the Civil War. It's a little tiny pocket knife. It's only about maybe 4 inches long. And it was called a paring knife or a fruit knife, we believe, so that the person who had it would use it to pare an orange or an apple or something like that and just kept it in his pocket. The one we have is sterling silver, and it's very elaborate. And it belonged to Governor Harvey, Louis P. Harvey, who was governor at the beginning of the Civil War. And should I tell the story?
Oh, yes, it's a fascinating story.
It is a fascinating story. Louis P. Harvey was inaugurated in March of 1862. He was elected in 61, but inaugurated in 62. The Battle of Pittsburgh Landing, also known as the Battle of Shiloh, happened in April of 62, the 6th and 7th. And there was three regiments of Wisconsin regiments in that battle, and they lost a little over 25%.
The notorious battle.
Yes.
Shiloh.
In deaths. So that was shockingly high, and so he decided he needed to go down there and take materiel. And, you know, surgeons and doctors came with him and went down there. So he went down there to help the soldiers. On the way back, however, he was waiting on a steamship for his steamship to arrive that would take him back to Wisconsin.
This is on the Tennessee River, is that right?
I don't remember. I think it is the Tennessee River. Oh, yes, it is the Tennessee River. And he was stepping from one boat to the other, and he slipped in the water. He fell in. There was a rescue attempts made. A cane. One of the doctors held out his cane to pull him in, and Harvey pulled the cane out of his hands. Another doctor dove in and tried to save him. But it was a very fast current, and he went under a nearby flatboat and was lost. And this is at 10 p.m. at night, so it's not
that makes it hard. Yes.
You can see him. So he was lost, and the Army or the Union did not know where he was for the next 14 days. We do know that this happened on the 19th. We do know that on the 27th, his body actually washed ashore further down the river, and children playing at the riverbank saw the body and asked, as they said, a Negro man to pull him ashore. They went through his pockets, I'm assuming taking his knife with him, which we know it's his knife because it has his initials engraved on them, and put his body back in the water. A local farmer heard about it and went and retrieved the body, was able to retrieve the body and bury it in a shallow grave. But before he did, he went through the pockets again and found papers that gave him a clue that this was the lost Wisconsin governor. And he saw a Union military steamship go by, and he hailed it and asked it to come ashore, and they retrieved the body, and they noticed all of his personal possessions were gone, and the farmer he kind of went back to all the kids and other people who had gone through the pockets and sort of used threats and condolences to return everything back. And we believe that's when the pocket knife was handed back over to someone who could get it back to Wisconsin. Following the written record, it ended up in his wife's hands, which is Cordelia Harvey, who went on to fame as a medical
proponent of veterans hospitals.
Veterans hospitals,
Wisconsin.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. So we do have a list that the attorney general turned them over to her. The knife is on the list. The strange thing is we got it from a Dr. Samuel Bell in 1913, I think, is the year that we acquired it. Very nicely, the Racine paper published an article about us being the Wisconsin Historical Society, receiving the knife as a Civil War relic. We have no idea how Samuel Bell got a hold of it. He told his nephew before he died that he was part of the party that found Governor Harvey's body, but I have tracked down his Civil War history, and that is physically impossible for him to have been there. But he said he told him that he knew that there was a secret pocket where the knife was hidden, and he got it out of the pocket. He was a medical student during the Civil War, and he also said he was a boyhood friend of Harvey. There was a 21-year difference between them, and Harvey was older.
Well,
not likely.
I guess that's back to when I was asking about embellishing. I mean, we all become a little bit more of the hero in our own stories, I guess, and to help make it so that we were there when there was action.
And that's kind of what happened. The only thing I could suppose is both of the Cordelia Harvey and Dr. Simon Bell ended up in Rock County after the war, towards the end of their lives. And there is a chance that she may have given it to him at that point, but there's no written record. All the written records say that he acquired it off the body, which is still kind of questionable, because why would he take a knife off the body and not hand it back to the widow?
Right.
It's now, a little peculiar.
Without the story, does the knife have value?
Well, it has value because we know it's Louis P. Harvey's. His initials are engraved in it. It's sterling silver, has financial value that way.
It's an antique.
It's an antique. But the story is what makes it from, just a little memento into sort of a historical significance.
Now you have a very interesting cane, too. You mentioned doctors. You mentioned canes. Yeah. And this brings those two together in a rather unexpected way.
Well, again, this is now in the Wisconsin Veterans Museum's hands, but we did have a cane that's really quite wonderful. You screw off the handle, which is gold-plated, and you pull out this long tube, and inside are little vials of medicine. We're not positive he used it. After I wrote about this and researched it, the Vets Museum, once they got it, did some more research, and they're not positive this was used by him in the field in the Civil War. But it was his, and he was a Civil War doctor. But it's still pretty amazing, and it is probably from that time period. So he could, without having to have a doctor's bag, could just walk around with his cane, and if something happened, he could open it up and pull out his little vials, and it could be quinine or opium or ipecac or calomel. Something
like
that.
Any of those things in demand.
And I suppose it kept it well protected if it was inside a hollowed out cane.
And it lasted. I mean, the vials are still in there with their stuff in them, so it lasted 150 years.
I don't know about the expiration date of the medicine. But.
Good way to keep them. We're going to look further at these artifacts of Wisconsin soldiers, and also from the home front, and also some presentation items from the Civil War pertaining to Wisconsin when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Leslie Belay, who's telling us about some of these fascinating artifacts relating to Wisconsin during the Civil War, many of them having to do with soldiers and some also with the home front, as we'll find out. But we've been talking about really the white perspective on the Civil War, whether North or South at this point. I'm wondering what you have that would illuminate the war, again, pertaining to Wisconsin artifacts from the terms of other races.
Well, there's a wonderful piece worn by Stockbridge Munsee, Native American. Stockbridge Munsee's settled in the Chilton area, but kind of between Fond du Lac and Green Bay. And they seem to be one of the few nations that were interested in fighting in the Civil War for the Union. Because the reality is most Native Americans, if they fought, fought for the Confederacy. They were anti-federal government. They're not going to go fight for,
well,
for the
sure.
U.S. government.
Well, sure. The less control and the less kind of domination of Indian lands and former Indian lands, the better from their standpoint. So they would want a looser confederation.
Yes. And so the Confederacy actively went after Native Americans to recruit them. The Union Army, on the other hand, forbid Native Americans to create their own companies. So not very many Americans joined the Army and became soldiers. In Wisconsin, there is thus one exception. There are about a little under 280 Native Americans who we know were soldiers. They almost all come from that Chilton area, that Stockbridge Munsee Nation. And one of the ones, the one of the most famous ones from that area was usually went by the name Stephen Nicholas. You see different versions, but I decided to call him. This one seems to show up the most, so I call him Stephen Nicholas. Sometimes you just see Nick or Steve, Steve Nick.
And what would have made him and the group that he was part of decide to be on the side of the Union?
There's usually three reasons given to why Native Americans might fight for the Union. And one is that they hope that by joining them, they would feel more inclined to honor their treaties.
sad
yeah.
Perspective.
Or what else? Let me try and remember.
Was any of it a sort of sense of sympathy with the cause of slaves?
Not really.
Not really.
I guess I just remember what the three are. Okay, one was that maybe they'd honor their treaties. One is the bounty money, because usually you got paid a bounty when you joined the Army. And the third one was this gave them a chance to prove themselves personally as warriors.
As warriors, mm-hmm. Which is still, a good reason that a major reason that Native Americans joined the military is that sense of the warrior.
I understand that, especially in the Vietnam War. I've heard that. So we believe Stephen Nicholas really, he had since a little kid wanted to be a soldier, a warrior. And this, so he, as soon as the war started, he tried to sign up. He didn't get in the first time he tried, but he finally got into the 1st Cavalry, which was created in Ripon, Wisconsin. He's just an amazing person. He's supposedly a descendant of Metacomb, who's also known as King Philip. King Philip's War happened in
1676.
Yes, 75,
76.
Yeah. Yep, and he is supposedly a descendant of him and had that warrior spirit mm-hmm. in him that King Philip had. We don't know who his parents are because he moved to Wisconsin when he was 5 with his grandparents who helped found Chilton. Looking at photographs of him, he looks like he might have some African-American in him, but he always called himself a Stockbridge Munsee ethnicity.
So, and what is this star artifact that you have?
So when he joined the Army, he became a private and a scout, and that's what he – a lot of Native Americans are scouts. And his fellow soldiers are just – this was a medal given to him by his fellow soldiers, and it's engraved with an eye. It's a circle with a 5-point star in it. Engraved with an eye. And we think the eye means scout, but we're not really sure.
It kind of, it looks Masonic.
It does kind of, but he was not Masonic. And I don't think they would have let him into the Masons at that time.
Not.
But he got this as a – actually what happened was he was captured by the Confederates at one point, and they were all put in prison. This was still early on in the war when prisoners were released pretty regularly. And while he was in prison, his fellow soldiers made this badge for him. He was known to be unusually brave and ferocious, but also kind and gentle when it was appropriate, so sort of the ultimate warrior. And stories were told about him in both contexts. So he was even offered a chance when he was captured to join the Confederacy. Because he was Native American, we believe Colonel Parsons of Texas, who's the one who captured him, his company captured him, asked him to come work for him. And Nicholas said no. He was going to stay a Union Army soldier. So when he got released, he joined the Army again and stayed with his same company and managed to survive and go back to Chilton. And he died in 1901.
One of the other artifacts that you have in the magazine article that jumped out for me in terms of just the power of seeing it is a slave collar, you know, a metal piece that would have gone around a slave's neck, and then these spikes that stick up. Can you talk about that piece?
And its connection to Wisconsin.
Yes, it does have a great connection to Wisconsin. And it's basically a brace that goes around your neck with two vertical spikes that hit behind the ears so that you couldn't turn your head. We are very lucky that we know the story of this piece and that it survived. It mainly survived because it was taken off a slave who had escaped and ended up with the 4th Wisconsin while they were stationed in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They removed it from him and sent it back to Wisconsin to be put on display to remind people what the war was about and what they were fighting for. But I could tell you the story of how we got the collar. I shouldn't include me into it, but Wisconsin got the collar. There was a slave named Old Steve, and he worked on a plantation in Louisiana. And some of Union company or regiments were sent over to his master's plantation to get fuel, which possibly was wood or coal. All the slaves were told to stay in hiding while they were visiting. But Old Steve and Charlie decided, and his friend Charlie decided, they wanted to see what these devil Yankees look like and went down and talked to them and just got to know them and then went back to work. But the master at the plantation was furious, and he whipped them. He shackled them. He put the slave collar on Old Steve, and he put them in stocks inside a calaboose, which is a slave jail, which is on his property. Despite of all of this manacled, they escaped. They got on the canoe and floated down to Baton Rouge, where the 4th Wisconsin was. And 4th Wisconsin is the regiment that first encountered him. And they sawed off the rivet that was holding it in place. And he became a cook for the company there. I think it was Company I of the 4th Wisconsin, and was eager to learn to read. And that's what he did for his few months there. And then later on, he decided to join the Army himself as part of an all-African-American group, and we lose track of him at that point. We're very lucky that one soldier who was in the 4th Wisconsin I Company wrote all about Steve and described him. He described him as a large, powerful man, over 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and solidly built in proportion, almost a perfect specimen of physical development.
And we have a photograph of...
Actually, there's no photograph of Old Steve, but there is a photograph of Wilson Chin, who was another Louisiana slave who escaped north. He decided in 1863, he was encouraged, I think, to put on a slave collar, to put on leg shackles, to show different kinds of slave whips, and in a photograph. And that photograph was sold in the North to raise money to help schools for blacks in the South.
Which objects move you personally, where you're looking at all these different things and you somehow feel a kind of emotional connection to something from the past?
Well, the slave collar really does that to you dramatically. The other piece that I feel very close to, we do have a vest that was worn by a soldier, and I keep studying it or studying his picture.
Yeah, his picture, there is something compelling about it.
Yes, it is. His name was Henry Clay Taylor, and he was from Fond du Lac. He was 26 years old when he joined the Army. And in 1862, he was a bookkeeper, so he was educated. And he had his picture taken right before he went off to war. And he's a very handsome man, I must say.
And kind of an intense expression.
Yes. And he got captured. He was a sergeant. He ended up actually at Libby Prison, which is in Richmond. And he was doing quite well there. And he sent letters home. We have all of his letters home in the archives here about how things are going. And it's okay. And he's kind of cheery. And then in April of 64, they end abruptly. And it turns out he became quite sick. But this is 64, and then the Union is moving south into Richmond, and they don't want to give up their prisoners. So they sent him and his fellow prisoners to Macon, Georgia. And when it looked like they were going to come up through Atlanta, they sent them up to Charleston, South Carolina. And he survived all of that, but died in South Carolina. And his friend wrote home to his parents that he had secured very kind treatment in Charleston and that the physicians took a particular interest in him. And he always expressed himself as determined to live through and get home, even up to the day he died. Mm. The vest that we have is a civilian vest that he wore before he went off to war. And it's black velvet with printed with flower baskets, repeating pattern flower baskets, which might sound kind of weird. But
it doesn't look very macho.
No. In the 1850s and 60s, the vest was the last bastion of where men could show personality in their clothing, where it could be colorful and have designs on it. But after the Civil War in the 1870s, that will all disappear. But, you know, you have to remember, men used to be the peacocks of the fashion world, if you think the 18th century. And it's only as the Industrial Revolution came in that their clothes got blacker, essentially.
Well, again, if you look at the Zouave uniforms, yes, those were the peacock of the whole bunch of Civil War uniforms.
And why does the State Historical Society have his vest?
It came down through his family, and we know it's his vest because on the inside it says Uncle Henry's vest to Will. And I figured out who Will is, which was his nephew. And I don't remember exactly which family member gave it to us, but it did come to us around 1920. It seems to be in the time around 1910 to 1925 where these men were dying off.
Right.
And they either made decisions themselves to turn over their stuff to a museum, or their family was left with it and decided they wanted to turn it over to a museum. So the bulk of our Civil War stuff came in between, I think, 1910 and 1925.
Okay. Old Abe.
Old Abe. Well, you have to remember about Old Abe that Old Abe no longer exists in any form. Old Abe was an eagle. He was the mascot for the 8th Wisconsin. And he was actually caught as an eaglet by a Chief Big Sky and then sold to some European Americans who lived out in western Wisconsin, who then sold it when the war started to the 8th Wisconsin for $2.50 to become their mascot. And he became a very famous mascot. And he saw 37 battles or skirmishes during the course of the war.
In a cage, presumably?
No.
No, actually, if you look at one of those pictures, he's just standing on a cannon, right? This is
but how do they keep
photograph
him there?
They clipped his wings.
So he didn't have much choice.
And he was tied to a T-shaped stick.
He was a tether. Yeah.
Tethered to that stick. Since he kept surviving all these battles, even though he was like, you know, he had no choice. The thing to keep in mind is he had no choice, but he would kind of lead the battles, he'd be leading the soldiers into battle. Someone would be carrying him, and someone wasn't responsible for him. And that changed over time as people were killed or left or whatever. But there's always one soldier who was in charge of him. And the Confederate Army realized that he was a major morale boost. And so by the end, the goal was to kill the eagle. And even with that goal, they still didn't manage to do it. And one time, I forget which battle, he actually got free of his tether and flew over the whole battlefield while it was happening and flew back home. And his wings were clipped, but he had a little flying ability. After that, they were clipped even further so that he wouldn't do that again. But his handler was so upset that his wings were clipped that much that he would no longer care for the bird.
And then the photograph of him, at least the one of the ones that we have, was taken by the famous Dells photographer.
H.H. Bennett took a photograph. It's probably the photograph of Old Abe. It's his post-war life. When he came back to Wisconsin, the 8th Wisconsin donated him to the state. And he lived in the state capitol in the basement till 1881, I think, about 16 years, and went out on tour a lot. And so what happened with all those tours is he'd go out on tours and he molts or sheds his feathers and people would pick up feathers. So what we have in our collection and what the Vets Museum also has are these feathers that were picked up by tourists who came to see Old Abe and wanted a memento of him and saved them, and eventually we got them.
And how do you know it's Old Abe as opposed to some other eagle?
We can't be positive, but usually the story, you know, like I said, there's these notes with them. I said... And usually we know exactly. This was Sarah so-and-so's who picked this up on July 4th, 1868, while visiting Old Abe. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's with it. So we're taking it at its word.
So you have how many feathers?
We have two in the museum and one in the archives.
Well, not enough to make an eagle.
The Veterans Museum has some more?
I think they have more like 12 to 15. They have a framed case of of Old Abe Eagle Feathers.
And so then Old Abe lives until 1881.
He actually dies from smoke inhalation during a fire at that point, but the belief was his health was already compromised by living in a basement, possibly, and the stress of being on the road when you're an eagle.
All those tours, those road shows.
And he went all over the country. I mean, he didn't just – we have someone writing about him, his visit in Massachusetts. So he was nationally known. He had books written about him.
And so where is he now?
Where is he now? Unfortunately, he does not exist now because he died in 81, and he was stuffed. And he was put into the Historical Society's museum, which at that time was at the Capitol. We built our building in 1900, 1901, and he moved into our building, which he would have been safe there because in 1904, Governor Robert La Follette asked that he be returned to the Capitol and be on display there. Unfortunately, in 1917, the Capitol burned and took Old Abe with him.
So all we have is those feathers.
So luckily, the feathers that have been saved over the years are all we have left of Old Abe.
What a story of survival.
We'll look at some presentation items from Wisconsin's connection to the Civil War when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Leslie Bellet, and we are talking about Wisconsin Civil War memories and mementos. Before we talk about some of the fancy presentation pieces that are in your collection, I was struck by the draft drum and the idea of a draft that was taking place that triggered riots, if I understand your article right.
That's right. Not this draft drum specifically, but drafts did create riots. Mainly the biggest one in Wisconsin was in Port Washington. And what happened is Lincoln thought he had enough people to fight the war after the first wave of volunteers joined the army, and then realized fairly quickly this war is not going to end anytime soon. And so asked for more volunteers. And for a while, Wisconsin could provide the quotas that were set per state. But as we got into 1863-ish, 64 time periods, people began realizing this war is not pretty, that war is ugly, it kills people in mass quantities, and maybe I don't want to join the army after all. So the draft was implemented. It was not very successful, definitely not very successful in Wisconsin. Just doing off the top of my head, I know that about 17,000 men were drafted, but about 3,700 actually showed up and were mustered in of the draftees. So a percentage of those, if I remember correctly, about 6,000 of them got exemptions, and you could get exemptions. Another portion would have bought a substitute for $300, and the last chunk were just draft dodgers. So what we have in our collection is a draft drum. It's a little hard to explain, but it's basically a cylinder on its side, and it's like a bingo, like a bingo ball thing, and you put... They cut little rectangles of squares of what they called cardboard. We'd probably call it heavy paper, with each man's name who could be drafted in it. They put them in, and then they would have a blindfolded person pull out the requisite number of names. And those would get published in the local paper, and people would know if they'd been drafted or not, and then find out whether they could get exempted or buy a substitute or just ignore it.
And I think part of your story was that there was an 8-year-old girl that was assigned the task of picking the number in hopes that that would protect them from the anger of people.
That's right. It wasn't Port Washington, but it was somewhere else along the east side of Wisconsin where Port Washington had happened. And what happened there was there was a draft riot. The guy in charge of the draft in Port Washington was attacked. His house was burned. Other Republicans were attacked because Republicans tended to be pro-war. German Americans did not want to be drafted. They had come to the United States to avoid mandatory army service. And they tended to be Democrats. So after that happened, a nearby town decided that they were going to use an 8-year-old girl to pull the names because they figured the the ruffians would not attack an 8-year-old girl. And they were correct. She did not get attacked, and the draft went on smoothly there.
Now, some of these, when we get into these presentation items, I gather it's not too challenging to document their route to your museum.
No, they're much easier because, for one thing, they're usually engraved with all the information you need to know about where they came from and who they went to. And they often, when they came to us, they came with all of this history documentation as well. The most important one we have is a silver punch bowl. There was also a sword that came with it, but it was a silver punch bowl given to Joseph Bailey. He eventually became a brigadier general. He was a lieutenant colonel at the time. But he helped save the Union Navy on the Red River in Tennessee.
He was an engineer?
He had been an engineer before joining the Army. And the Navy was trapped on the Red River. The water was low in the river, and they couldn't sail their ships down. And they were about to be attacked by Confederate soldiers there who were doing a really good job on land attacking the Union. And they're afraid now the Navy was under attack. And so he came up with the idea of building a dam that would raise the water level so the boats could actually float down the river. And it took 2 weeks to build, but they did. Managed to build it. And they floated their ships.
And then blew the dam, too, after that.
They blew the dam afterwards so that no one could follow them. And the admiral at the time, I think it was Admiral Porter, was so impressed with this, and he saved the Navy. He saved a big chunk of the Navy that they had Tiffany in New York make him a silver punch bowl and a sword. What makes this punch bowl kind of unique, besides the fact it's engraved with all this, in fact, it's engraved, presented to Brigadier General Joseph Bailey. He was promoted after this event by Rear Admiral Porter and the officers composing the Red River Expedition as a mark of their esteem and as a memento of an event so creditable to the skill and energy of General Bailey, the construction of the dam which saved to the nation a valuable squadron.
That's a long engraving.
I was going to say, that's a lot,
it would take
a lot of engraving.
But it's a very big punch bowl.
With alligators.
Yes, it does have alligators on it, which is sort of the unique addition to this punch bowl, because there were alligators in the Tennessee River, which I think really caught the Union Navy sailors' attention, and may have been kind of a dangerous experience. They had Tiffany add three-dimensional alligators to the base of the to the base of the bowl.
Were you ever tempted to sneak one of these artifacts out and take it to the Antiques Roadshow?
No.
Well, it's interesting.
Just my boss heard that.
It's interesting that in the engraving, it's referred to as a memento, and it's as if they wanted to create something that would last. And it's kind of fitting then that there it is in a museum, preserving for all time that moment.
That's right. And what we've been talking about are generally mementos that were saved, but it's just haphazard. It's accidental history that these particular small little pieces happen to make it to the present. But the presentation pieces were always meant to be mementos of the Civil War. They were deliberate and hopefully would pass through generations like
now,
they have.
This particular punch bowl, was that actually made during the war, or was it one of the post-war celebrations that brought it about?
We're not quite sure. We know that was made sometime between the Red River episode, which was 64, and he died in 67. So
it's a very narrow time
frame of when it could have been made. My guess is he got it right as the war was ending.
You also mentioned in your articles some artifacts that belong to General Starkweather. Can you tell us about those?
As General Starkweather, he wasn't a general at the time. He was a colonel. But we have a water pitcher and goblets and also a cane. There's two different stories related to them. And the cane he gave to his father, and it's engraved on the head in sterling silver with all the battles he fought in, up through the Battle of Chickamauga, which happened in 1863, where he was wounded and didn't really fight an active battle after that. That was September of 63. And the pitcher and goblets are also sterling silver, and they were given to him for gallantry and bravery through the war by his staff and officers. And by this time, in 64, when he received it on August 17th, 64, it says on there, he had been assigned to take care of Pulaski, Tennessee, and make sure it didn't get turned over to the Confederacy. He was supposed to defend the lines of communication, and he was headquartered in Pulaski, Tennessee. So this picture also says on it that it's given to him by the citizens of Pulaski, Tennessee. So that was August 17th. By August 30th, General Nathan B. Forrest of the Confederacy had come in and taken over Pulaski, and he was run out. So they were a little premature in their gift. The interesting thing about Starkweather then is he really wanted to be part of the Atlanta campaign and be an officer on that campaign. But General Sheridan, who acquired that, who he wrote to and said, "Can I be in the Atlanta campaign?" The words that have been used as bluntly rejected his application. And so that became kind of an interesting thing. I need to find out why he was bluntly refused.
Bluntly refused.
I mean, Starkweather, to us, not many people heard of him now, but at that time he was a Wisconsinite of great renown.
Something to do with losing Pulaski, maybe?
Possibly. But some other people wrote later that he was only slowly recovering from his wounds, suffering from depression. And the officers in Pulaski wrote that he had that he was drunk and had been for some time.
Oh, that's another possibility. Yes.
So I think it's a kind of combination of those things. He did go back to Wisconsin, became a farmer. He was a lawyer before the war, and eventually returned to being a lawyer and died in Washington, D.C. in 1890.
So the mementos definitely bring with them memories. Our guest today has been Leslie Belay. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.